Although all traces virtually have been eliminated at this point, except for the excessive number of theater lights still on our main rafter, this temple for the last 4 days has been the scene of our annual school play. Every year, with ever-increasing, almost lunatic commitment on the part of the faculty, we put on a performance that involves all the children in our school, ranging from the 4-year-olds to the 14-year-olds. This year, 60 children. Every year, the play is on the life of some great soul. And so in the course of rehearsing this play, which is always an original script written by one of the faculty members usually, the children immerse themselves completely in the life of a great soul. Even the littlest ones who have very tiny roles on stage sit through many rehearsals and to an astonishing degree memorize the whole play. Whenever any child misses his lines, there's 40 or 50 children who can just start reciting them. Gary McSweeney, who's our middle school teacher now, his son was a founding student. And in his first year, he was about 5, and he, with famous McSweeney willpower, which we all know through Gary, absolutely refused to go on stage. And with the wisdom of his teacher, Barbara, which we also know and respect, she said, "That's fine, dear." And Brian sat on Barbara's lap through the whole performance that first year and recited every single line of the play. He wouldn't go on stage, but he'd memorize the whole play. Now, of course, this is a fantastic learning experience because the quality of what the play is not the usual sort of rabbits and bunnies and things like that that school plays, you know, talking watermelons and things like that, that school plays often are. This is the actual life of a great soul. In this case, we did the life of Mirabai, who was an Indian princess, poet, and mystic who was deeply devoted to Krishna. So our whole experience, I say our, I was involved in the costume part of it, but our, because many of you attended, was this experience of this great devotee of Krishna and all that she had to put up with in her devotion to God. And over the course of the years, we were laughing because there's a point of, you have to create some drama in this. There was the point of drama where Mira's husband had died and her brother-in-law was trying to get her to go into the funeral pyre with him to commit sati, I guess it's called. I had a long discussion with one of the Indian mothers. It's hard for me to imagine that such a barbarous practice was actually common in such a refined culture as India. But nonetheless, there it is. So this one mother was saying to me, "I didn't expect at the age of 6 to be discussing with my child the concept of you know, a widow putting herself on the funeral pyre." We said, "Well, you know, we did the life of Jesus. We did the life of Moses. We've slaughtered the innocents many times with these children. In fact, those are the scenes they love the most, when the lights go red and everybody starts screaming and people get to run around with swords." I worked with the children on this play, and there was one battle scene, the necessary battle scene, and I think the children were far more interested in what they called their battle dress. I mean, here I am, you know, weaving sequins and making these beautiful things, and all they want is this big thing that they slash over them so they can run around and go like this. They're most concerned with it. And, you know, in the whole experience of it, I don't normally work with children, although I myself have almost forgotten all through high school, Creative Children's Theater was what I did. It was my first job and the first thing I did until I came to the spiritual path, in fact. So it's kind of like being thrown back into something. I highly recommend a complete change of service whenever you can do it. I mean, not to stop serving, but to serve in like a way that takes your mind into a whole other part. So being with children and fabric and theater for me, except for the fact that I had another job I was also supposed to be doing, it was just wonderful to immerse myself. Also, because I'm not naive about children. Children are just big egos and small bodies. There's nothing really more pure about them inherently, except that there's a little hiatus until about the age of 12. Karma kind of takes a little holiday, and children get to have what's known as the innocence of ignorance. It's not like they've actually faced the challenges that life have given them and mastered them, which is the innocence of saints. They're just having a little karmic holiday and just getting to play it out and getting to have that detachment from self-concern That is what is the real goal of the spiritual path. Swami Kriyananda has emphasized on many occasions, and it's a thought really deeply and profoundly to keep in mind. We tend to think of self-realization as an ever and ever greater sense of who I really am, especially in our culture, which worships above all personal power. You know, personal power is everything. And so we think of self-realization as just sort of like this mega super Walmart, you know, giant store version of personal power, where in fact, true self-realization is just self-forgetfulness, just a complete absence of self-concern in the contemplation of something so much larger. And you see little children acting this out because they're not sophisticated enough to be embarrassed. One of my, what I can only call dumber ideas in this particular play, because I tend to forget that these are children. I think I'm making costumes and I forget that I'm putting them on children who have what I can only describe a pure genius for doing things inside of their clothes that you would never imagine anybody could ever do. So no matter how much you pin and tie and, you know, strap them in, they find some way to, you know, get their head into the armhole and their foot into the hem. And one of the ideas I had was that we would put the little Gandhis, we had three narrators who were supposed to be Gandhi, we would put them in genuine dhotis. Dhotis are an extremely clever Indian garment, which is like 5 yards of uncut fabric that's just folded and knotted and wrapped around. And even though it's falling out of fashion in India, Indian men wear them quite confidently all the time and they don't fall off. Gandhi himself wore one. 8-year-old children, however, is a whole nother story. You wrap these kids in this, and this one darling little boy who's just so positive. With all due respect, I imagine, Dambara, if I had known you as a child, you would be like this little boy. He was always enthusiastic. And we actually had a new experience this time, which is costumes actually fell off the children, which is something that had never happened. The motto of the costume department is no living wisdom child has ever gone naked on stage, but we were real close this time. So this little boy, he would just come to me with his costume in his arms, little fragments of it still on his butt. He'd come down to me like this, and he would say, "It fell off again," like this, you know. "What are we going to do now?" And we'd try to wrap him in it. Finally, I got him completely in it so it wouldn't fall off. He was on this side of the room. I'm on this side. This is during performance, actually. And he snake wiggles all the way across on his tummy, all the way across, to show me that one of his legs is trapped inside of it. He can't get it out. He lies on the floor and shows me that he can't stand up anymore. I could hardly, you know, the performance is going on. I had to try to be, but I was in hysterics. I could hardly hold it together. But you see, you step into this world and you see these little children, and we had the tiniest ones were dressed like little peacocks, and we found this sort of stiff fabric and we put them in these little things so they looked like these little plump birds. And it was this beautiful material. So the children, I remember, this is just putting you into it, I have this memory of myself as a ballet dancer when I was taking ballet at 6. My inner experience of me as a ballet dancer was Margot Fonteyn, absolutely, with a little bit of Nureyev, you know, thrown in like this. And I remember my costumes, and I remember dancing, and then I found a photograph. Just this little skinny kid like this. But inside, you know, it was so different. Master actually said so sweetly that often the commitment children have to a vision of themselves that's so much grander than what you're watching is actually, they're actually reliving past incarnations in which, in fact, whatever they're fantasizing about, they were, you know, because they're small now, but they weren't always small. They lived through many lifetimes in which they accomplished. And so they live out that accomplishment of being a great athlete or a great artist. I also remember very, very vividly, I couldn't have been more than 4, my next door neighbor and I, who for some peculiar reason was called Wibbles, probably one of those horrible childhood nicknames. Anyway, my girlfriend named Wibbles, we did sculpture. And I remember my statue. It was 3 balls of mud, one on top of the other like a snowman. But in my mind, it was just such a piece of art. And I remember carefully carrying it to my mother and trying to get her to put it in the oven You know, three balls of mud I wanted to put in the oven. I think I was trying to bronze it, quite honestly. I wanted to bronze it, and I felt if she would put it in the oven, then it would come out and it would last forever. And I was so bewildered. I think she tried in some way to accommodate me, but I was so bewildered by the fact that we couldn't bring this to completion. You know, our own inner realities are so different, and it's transparent with children because they don't have the ego structure to mask it. They don't know, as Swami says, how to dissemble yet. They don't know how to pretend. I was starting to say the little peacocks would get on stage, and they were so cute once we saw them. Matthew, the director, kept dragging them up. Every time he had a moment, he would drag the little peacocks on stage, and the little tiny ones would stand on the side and be little peacocks. And you would just see them just about to burst with excitement to be standing in front of all these people. And one little girl saw her mother, and just like as if no one could see her, I guess off to the side, just that complete lack of inhibition about whatever comes out of them wanting to be whoever they are. And this is why in the Bible there's the story, and they started bringing the children forward for Jesus to bless, and some protested. You can just see it. I mean, I don't expect biblical children were any more restrained in their self-expression than present-day children are, and it probably started disrupting what somebody thought was a holy occasion to bring all these kids up who were undoubtedly screaming and crying and pulling on Jesus' beard and whatever it is that children do and asking embarrassing questions. Why does that man have palsy over there? Somebody has to answer. So they tried to stop them, take them away. And Jesus said, "Suffer little children to come unto me, for of such are the kingdom of heaven." One of the greatest lines of the Bible, of which there are so many, how can you say? But there's a real profound and deep teaching there. Master tells us that everything in this world is symbolic of some deeper reality. This is how God tries to communicate with us, because it's difficult for us to grasp in the abstract what is really going on in this world. In our scripture reading, it says today that Jesus was saying, you know, no one has come down to heaven except he who has ascended. No one has ascended to heaven except he who has come down from heaven. And the scripture reading says, but Jesus was trying to say that even the Son of Man, which is what he used when he was referring to his physical body and not just his spirit unrelated to that, that he was simultaneously conscious of both the infinite and the ephemeral world. That's an extraordinary thing to think about, simultaneously conscious. We tend to think about these things as being very divided. Master says the astral world, the unseen worlds, are absolutely present, even in the world that we see with our eyes. And as Jesus walked through the streets of Jerusalem or wherever else he was simultaneously present of both the infinite and the finite. What an extraordinary image for all of us, and that's the direction that we're trying to go. We're not trying to leave behind anything. I was speaking once in Houston, Texas, many years ago, and in some context, I was giving a little bit of my own autobiography, how I was raised in a Jewish family, and now I follow this path, and so on. And some man who was quite a determined heckler, he started becoming very accusative of me for abandoning my Judaism. And I said, "That's your word for it. I haven't abandoned anything. Everything that I am and have ever been is still a part of me." And this, of course, goes back. I was speaking more metaphysically than he was thinking. Every past life experience is still right here with us. It's all registered in the vrittis, in the chakras. It's all that karma gets carried from lifetime to lifetime. I wanted to say, no such luck. You think you can just take some little part of yourself and cut it out and throw it away? It's always with us. We are nothing but the accumulated experience of all that time. I said, I haven't left anything behind. I've just seen it in a larger and a larger and a larger context. And that's what it is that we're seeking here. But what we're seeking is still exemplified in the tininess of the children. Their context is extremely narrow, oddly enough. But in that narrowness, to show us what is possible, they also have this remarkable freedom of spirit, this remarkable ability just to live in the now and just to enjoy it and to find the greatest pleasure in the smallest things. No, our lives right now in this society that we're living in at this stage of the world, We have enjoyed a sort of run of extraordinary prosperity in the last half century in America. I mean, we live at a level of comfort and leisure and freedom. Leisure, I know many of you work extremely hard, but understanding freedom from hard physical work and from want and the ability to go where we want and do what we want and live with so much. And it's not necessarily a certainty that we're going to be able to continue in an uninterrupted manner like this. At the very least, this vibration of insecurity has swept over our whole culture. And you sort of see this, even if people are not yet financially impaired, there's still this standing still, waiting to see what happens. Now, Master himself said 50 years ago that inevitably there would have to be a balancing time in the history of our country. There would have to be a time in which this excessive luxury, which was not necessarily serving us spiritually, was going to have to be balanced. He said, and there would be a period of hard transition. He said, but afterwards, as we settled into something more appropriate, given the global scale, given true human nature, he said people would have, and these were his words exactly, half as much wealth, but much more happiness. And you watch these little children, this little girl sitting next to me in this play, a little bit of a flower fell off of Krishna's artificial garland. She had this little tiny flower in her hand, and it's partly because she's just a child and her brain is not highly developed. She spent much of the night just sort of poking at that flower and just having such an extremely interesting time with that flower. Now, any adult who would do that would be considered mentally impaired, so I'm not actually suggesting that we become that kind of person. But the fact is, if we allow ourselves to be who we really are as created by God, there is this simplicity to our nature, this easy satisfaction, this wellspring of natural happiness that we have become so agitated about. You know, I just heard a little thing on the radio. Everybody's doing studies now about, you know, this wonderful media culture that we live in. Now that we have less money, everybody's studying how it is that we have less money, and we're interviewing people about less money. And I just heard this family. Well, every Friday night we used to order pizza from Joe's pizza place down the street, and that used to cost us $24. Now we make our own pizza, and it costs us $7.34, whatever it was. But the mother said, our boys, our sons, 4 and 7 years old, have so much more fun making their own pizza than they ever did buying it. You know, just it's such a simple thing, isn't it? But all of a sudden, you see, we've gotten into this habit of to find pleasure, we spend money. You know, it's just the way we move. If we want to do something, we spend money. We take our family somewhere and we spend a lot of money. And almost always in that spending, there's all this stimulation coming. It's astonishing when you turn on the television these days. I was with my aunt, who's 90, 89. We were in her place in Philadelphia. We were watching the news. And she said, she keeps clicking her hearing aids. And she says, what's that sound? And what that sound was while the news was going on, there was some kind of, I want to say rock and roll, but I know that makes me sound quaint. I don't think that's even what you call it anymore. But there was just some kind of modern sound going, like this, to make the news more exciting, I guess. I don't know what it was. So this newscaster's trying, this poor, you know, sort of elderly newscaster's trying to say it, and dum dum bum, dum dum bum. And all my aunt thinks is there's something wrong with her hearing aids. But the problem is, once you start stimulating yourself in that way, you become accustomed to it. And the only way to get any level of stimulation is to go farther and farther. And then you see the television and there's 6 or 7 different patterns flashing behind at the same time. And the newscaster has 4 different people on the screen and he keeps interrupting everyone else. It just has to go faster and faster and faster, faster and faster and faster and faster and faster until what is actually going to happen. And that's really where we are. That's really where we are. But it's not because God wants anything from us except absolute bliss. It's just that he's really saying to us, are you really enjoying yourselves? Are you really, really finding what you know is yours? And so it says here, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. You know, the pure in heart is not this. I know Joseph Campbell, who was so, did such marvelous work, you know, giving us a picture of the richness of mythology and culture and the importance of these bigger visions of reality to the health of a society. My favorite part of all his interviews, all those hours, was when Bill Moyer says, but what happens to a culture when it no longer has connection with these wonderful traditions? And Joseph Campbell pointed out the window and said, this. Because the only cultures that we've had attached to don't work for us anymore. You know, the dogmatic religions, the separation of denominations, the our way is better, we Americans are the best, you're not good anymore. I mean, even in our Bay Area, as I understand it, we're, what did they say, one-third Latino in some way, from one South American or Mexico, from South and Central America and Mexico, one-third Asian, Chinese, Indian, Japanese, and then one-third what used to be the dominant culture here. You can't really look around and say, you just walk around Monroe Avenue, where our community is located, and it's a plethora of languages and cultures, just from house to house to house, Russian, Chinese, South American, you know, Spanish. Everything is being spoken, just taking a little walk, Hindi, Maharashtra, everything, it's just everything is there. It's like those old systems of our separation just don't work anymore. But we're having a very difficult time sort of figuring out what the new form is. Well, I don't mean to be partisan to my own cause, but this is the new form. And I don't mean Paramhansa, Yogananda, Ananda Church, the great, you know, Catholic Church of the future. Yogananda put it very differently. He said, self-realization is the unifying force behind all religions. And that is the understanding that needs to come for us to move out of whatever dissonance is coming to us into the harmony that's also coming. What self-realization represents is a simple return to the purity of heart, a simple return to the understanding that we are God's children. And whatever particular clothes we wear just adds to the color and the charm of the story. For 17 years, we've been doing a different great soul every year for these school plays. And two of our young brothers had a discussion at a certain point in the progression of this. And they had been through, among others, the play Joan of Arc and the play about Moses, you know, in which the children got to run around and scream a lot in both of those. You know, Joan of Arc was one of the favorites because it was nothing but war. And at least in the Moses play, we got to slaughter the innocents. So there was a moment that there was a fantastic moment where every child in the school got to scream at the top of his lungs as the innocents were slaughtered. That was marvelous. But anyway, the boys were arguing with each other, or discussing, because one boy said, Joan of Arc and Moses were just the same. And the other boy said, well, how can that be true? You know, Moses was Jewish. He had to fight against the Egyptians. Joan was a woman. She was French. And then one of the brothers resolved it. He said, yes. He said, but they both listened to God and did exactly what he told them to do. Out of the mouths of babes, isn't it true? And what Yogananda tells us is what's required now is an individual rededication to God. Not rededication to my God or your God or his God or their God. Nothing like that. A rededication to what God really is. God is that power and the presence, that uplifting reality within us that causes us to be able to stare at a flower and see in it an infinity of joy, that causes us to think about one another in terms of the unity of life as brothers and sisters. What one person suffers, we all suffer. When one has lack, we all have lack. We have to learn to look at one another with the eyes of the divine, with that kind understanding that yet has the courage to allow us to learn our own lessons. God does not interfere. When he sees us doing something foolish that is going to destroy our happiness, Divine Mother loves us enough to let us suffer. We cannot set up a culture in which we're going to try to intervene in everybody's to protect everybody from everyone else's ignorance. It's just not possible. What we have to have is an inner relationship with the infinite again that moves us beyond this absolute worship of personal power. Because personal power works great until it doesn't work at all, right? That's what's happening to us now. We've all been trained that we can do it. Yes, we can. We can do it. Anything you set your mind to, we can do. And then this great cosmic impossibility of a whole banking system going to pieces just happens all around us. And no matter how hard we try, you know, we can't just generate our personal power and make it work. Because our personal power is an expression of something so much greater. And only when we link that wonderful, optimistic, can-do spirit that characterizes America with our origin point, which is we're here as an expression of the infinite. When we remove from our heart the impurity of this mistaken commitment that I'm the one in charge, and come back to that sweet simplicity of the children, with the wisdom of experience, with the knowledge that God doesn't always make it easy for us. And sometimes challenge has to come, and sometimes in this world very difficult things happen that cannot be explained away. And we cannot just say, oh, like this, everything will be fine, dear, and they lived happily ever after. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they don't live happily ever after at all. And so the happiness we're seeking has to be rooted in something far deeper than just a little kind of point of view. We have to constantly, just as Jesus was, we don't descend to this world unless we also came down from a heavenly realm. This is personal spiritual practice. Whether you formally meditate according to Kriya Yoga, which I highly recommend, of course, whether your prayer relationship with God is of your own making, but each one of us at this time, at all times, but we're just fortunate enough to be slightly insecure in our external lives. This is the really good news. The illusion of security in this world is being gradually undermined. What a wonderful opportunity it is to get back to what's really real. You know, all we can ever have is our consciousness. That's all we ever have. What are we paying the most attention to? Our shoes? Our haircuts? You know, one of my friends was dying. She had about a week to live, and she knew it. She had let go of all care. She had cancer. And one of my other friends said to her, just, you know, just the way you are, your hair looks really cute like that. She just snapped back with absolute courage, I'm going to be the cutest little corpse you ever saw. Can you imagine? But you know, it's like, yeah. It's fine while we're living. You might as well be a nice visual display for our friends. After all, they have to look at us. Gives us, you know, it gives us a way to entertain ourselves. Swamiji says to dress nicely as a service to others because, as he says, they're the ones who have to look at you, right? But simultaneously, let us never forget, we are children of the light, and we have one purpose in this world, and that really is to radiate that light, just to be light bearers. That's the name that Swamiji gave to those of us who wear these robes. But it was a symbol, is a symbol. We have to be the bearers of the light. You know, somebody somewhere in all of this changing world has to hold on to the unchanging. Let it be us, both for the sake of the joy it will give us and also for what we can give to others. This is a sad, sorry world in many ways. You know, bring it a little joy, bring a little happiness, bring a little courage, bring a little faith in God. And at the end of your life, you'll be able to look back and say, I did a good thing. This life really counted. Look what I gave to others. Look what I found of God. It was worth it.